Welcome to Know the Name, Know the Answers. This is your host, Sharon Lynn Wyeth, and I am always so pleased that you've taken your time to join us. My guest for you tonight is Brian, and I'm not sure it's D. Clacco. I think that's how you pronounce his last name, but I'm not really sure. Brian, you want to correct me?
Well, first of all, there's no L, so you can leave that out. It's D. Clacco.
Okay, I knew I had it wrong.
I like the way you pronounce it, though. We'll go with D. Clacco from now on.
No, let's not. Okay, so anyway, I heard Brian at an event where I was pitching to different radio people and podcasters, and so was he. And his pitch so moved me, I invited him on this show months and months and months ago. And he finally got back to me, and I grabbed him the minute I could because I thought you were all just going to love this man. His pitch was literally a poem. And the poem was, I know why people struggle and why they don't achieve. I know why it's hard to rise and sometimes hard to breathe. It's got a lot of noise coming in. Brian, that noise coming in.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
there's construction in my neighborhood and my Wi-Fi went out today, so I decided to come to the Marriott across the street from me and sit in the lobby where I thought it would be quieter. That's yeah. Why I was hoping to use my microphone, that way it wouldn't pick up the
Okay, well, we need to do something because it's so loud. I don't think people can hear me. Okay, let's try again. So we'll just do it over again. So this is the poem that Brian pitched to me that I just thought, how fabulous. And then to hear him talk, I thought, oh, we all need to be listening to Brian. His pitch was, I know why people struggle and why they don't achieve. I know why it's hard to rise and sometimes hard to breathe. And there's no purpose why you're not here. There's nothing in the world to care about and nothing to hold dear. Now, Brian has gone through a lot of depression, tried suicide. Obviously, he's here with us. That didn't work. But he's really looked at depression. And I want him to tell his own story because hearing it from him is so much better than hearing it from me. And so, Brian, if you tell us what led you to depression or how you got depressed and what you did to get out of it and what you're doing now, I think it's a remarkable story.
Well, thank you very much, Sharon. First, I want to say thank you. I'm very humbled and honored to be with you today, especially given all the technical issues we had with emails. I know that you could have given up on me anytime, and thank you for having faith and trust and listening to your intuition. I hope that my story can really be of value for your audience and your listeners today. How is my audio sounding to you?
It's good. It's good. Right now, we're good.
I was able to figure out the microphone issue, so hopefully we're not getting any background noise. Well,
no, much better. Thank you.
Have you ever heard of INGE?
Isn't that a place where you can get loans?
I think that's ENG, but or just ING.
I don't know.
It's a medical diagnosis that I sort of came up with, and it's something that I was affected with at an early, early age. Statistically speaking, I would suggest that probably 7 out of 10 people probably have it. When you have it, it causes chronic emotional and physical exhaustion. It destroys our ability to live happy and fulfilled lives. It causes frequent suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts, and all too often it can become fatal if left untreated. You know, you asked me to speak here today based on my multiple suicide attempts and my struggle with depression. So I'm going to rewind the clock to when I'm a senior in high school. Okay. I'm a senior in high school. I'm playing every sport I can except for basketball. White men can't jump. I wasn't very good at basketball, but I loved every other sport. Varsity letterman in every sport I played. I had a cute girlfriend and a B average.
So it sounds like you had everything going for you.
Sounds like it. Looks good on the surface, right?
Right.
But in my life, growing up, good was never good enough. B's should have been A's. One goal should have been two. If I caught an interception in football, I should have returned it for a touchdown. I'm a senior in high school, and 6 months after my grandfather died unexpectedly from an aortic aneurysm, my grandmother was diagnosed with brain cancer. She came to live with us and for about 6 months, and undergoing the chemotherapy and radiation, her decline was precipitous as a hailstone. There were many days when I would come home from school and I would find her lying on the floor with her pants around her ankles, and she would have soiled herself on the way to the porta potty, which was only like 2 feet away from the bed. I don't personally believe that any grandson should ever have to wipe his own grandma or clean up the mess left on the carpet. But a week after her funeral, I got a note from my girlfriend. Do you remember when you were in high school, Sharon, and everything that was really, really, really important was communicated with fancy folded notes?
Oh, yes. And how you unfold them, that's half the fun.
That's half the fun. And you get so excited, especially when it's from somebody that you care about, right?
Right.
Well, I got a note from my girlfriend. I was very excited to open it and to find out that she had fallen in love.
Not with you, though.
It just wasn't with me. It was with my best friend.
Ah, I had that happen to me too in senior in high school. Go ahead.
Brutal, right? And this was a time, I mean, we had been dating for 8 months, and 8 months in high school is like marriage and baby carriage kind of stuff, right? So suffice to say, that was a pretty devastating day, especially so closely following my grandma's demise, my grandpa's funeral. And I went home, and that night was the first time that I attempted to take my life. And that was because I actually went to lunch with my best friend, and I said, you know, you and I have been friends for about 5 years, and I don't want to lose this friendship over a girl. And he stood up, and I'll never forget the look in his eyes. He looked at me in the eyes, and he stood up, and he slammed the table, and he said, you know what, BC, you and I were never really that close to begin with. And right. So grandfather dies, grandmother dies. Cancer, wiping my grandma's butt. Girlfriend breaks up with me for my best friend. My best friend tells me we were never really that close. That night I go home and I attempted to take my life. Obviously, that didn't succeed. I was saved by the grace of God or whatever deity.
You just weren't good at it. One more thing, not good enough. Go ahead.
Exactly. Well, obviously, it wasn't my time, right?
Correct.
So I graduate from high school, I move out, I get an apartment, a motorcycle, and a new girlfriend. But I'm still infected with this INGE. I still felt worthless and disposable. I still have INGE, and INGE makes us do some really stupid things. Have you ever heard of passive suicide?
No.
So passive suicide is when we do things, self-deprecating behaviors, when we care so little about our life that we don't care what happens to us. Often it's manifested in police-assisted suicide, alcoholism, various addictions, and whatnot. So one night I'm riding my motorcycle, and I'm supposed to have dinner with my folks. And in my house, I was raised in a military household, and late wasn't in our vocabulary. So I'm doing 85 in a 35-mile-an-hour zone, and a little green pickup truck pulls out in front of me, and I T-boned him doing just under 80. I was a broken, bleeding, mangled mess. I had compound fractures of both my femurs, 6 broken ribs, bleeding internally with bones sticking out through my pants. My heart stopped beating in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. It stopped beating in the ER when they were trying to put me back together like Humpty Dumpty again. And again, the third day, when my lungs filled up with blood and bone marrow, they went to intubate me, and my heart stopped again then.
You know, that just hurts hearing about it.
It's a pretty brutal visualization. I mean, the people have movies running through their mind when I tell them this story, and it's kind of rough to listen to. But I honestly believe that that was the best day of my life, and I'll get to that a little bit later. Obviously, I lived. I was in the hospital for six and a half weeks. I was in physical therapy and rehab for 18 months trying to relearn how to walk. But the doctors couldn't cure my INGE.
I want to know what that stands for.
I bet you do.
Okay, keep going, Brian.
So now I'm almost 20, right? And up until this point, I had been a pretty good kid. Some truancy, the occasional fight, running from the cops on my motorcycle, stupid things like that, just to see if I could. But nothing particularly egregious. But my recovery, after my recovery from my motorcycle accident, things got really dark. I didn't wreck my motorcycle to die, but I certainly did not want to live. In fact, I resented the fact that I lived. So I said a big F you to God and the universe and started hanging out with a gang, started doing drugs, and my drug of choice turned out to be methamphetamine. I spent the next 2.5 years in a tweaked out, paranoid pit of sorrow and despair so dark that I can hardly even remember it today. So enough of the trauma and the drama, right? You're ready for the good news?
Yes, most definitely.
This has been kind of downtrodden. The good news is I haven't touched an illegal substance in over 17 years. I started and ran a custom furniture company for 15 years. I wrote a book. I donated bone marrow to a four-year-old with leukemia. I started a nonprofit organization. And I have at least three friends that will tell you that they wouldn't be here today if I hadn't been there for them in their darkest hour. And a couple of years ago, I found out what the heck INGE actually is. So are you ready? You ready for the secret?
Yes, more than ready for INGE.
INGE is the I'm not good enough disease. Sometimes we catch it from loving parents who believe too much in us, like a B should be an A or one goal should be two or whatever. We could always do better. That kind of inoculates us with this belief that what I did wasn't good enough, ergo I'm not good enough. Sometimes we get it from friends who don't believe in us at all. They just we are the culmination of our five closest relationships, right? So sometimes we hang out with the wrong people and they don't think that anything good can come of us. But usually it just festers in us and grows. And when we begin comparing ourselves to others, and this is what happened in me. Nothing I ever did was ever good enough that would cause me to be lovable. At my core, I believe that I was unlovable.
You know, I think that's a common reaction when we feel like we're not good enough. What I find fascinating with your story, Brian, is that if I came home with a B on a report card, the first question was, why isn't that an A? Who are you sitting next to? Who are you flirting with? Because right. If you hadn't been flirting, that would have been an A. And that I was always busy. And again, it was always, why didn't you do more? Why didn't you whatever? Right. And I look at it and like I graduated from a 680 people in my graduating high school class, but I was in the top 10% and I had awards and whatnot. And I look at it too, that I dated the same person every Saturday night all the way through my senior year. And he asked me to the prom early because he knew I played, you know, and went out with different people on Friday night. And he asked me early, and then like 2 weeks before the prom, he says, oh, I'm in love with Paula, and I'd really like to take Paula. Aww. And I said, I don't want you going with me. If you don't want to go with me, go with Paula. I don't want you with me all night long, and then you thinking of Paula, you know?
Right.
And so a lot of what you're saying is very similar, and I think some of that, for some of us, is just part of being in high school, and yet, when I'm listening to you, Brian, I'm thinking, but for God, there goes I. I could have done that. I mean, I can tell you the number of times in my life I've thought of suicide, never tried it. My faith in the divine always kept me from going too far, if that makes sense. In eighth grade, I was like, I hate this life. I don't want to be here. I want out. Yep. And then I thought, where are the answers? And so I earned a Bible and started reading. And literally, that's what I said, but for God, there goes I, because that was my salvation. So what did you do? I mean, I know that I turned that way, but what did you do to get yourself turned around from this horrible downward cycle that you were in to being where you are now? What's the difference?
So are you familiar with Viktor Frankl?
No, I am not.
His name is spelled, for your audience members, his name is spelled Viktor Frankl. He is a German man who survived both Auschwitz and Dachau. and he watched every single one of his family members except for his sister die in the concentration camps at the hands of the Nazis. He ended up being a phenomenal psychiatrist and psychologist, and he wrote something during his time in Auschwitz, and he said in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, which I highly, highly recommend. If there's one gift that I can give to everybody listening today, not just those who are struggling with depression and suicidal ideation, but anybody that's struggling to have hope and optimism or find their place in the planet, read this book. It's really, truly phenomenal. And he says in this book, there's nothing in the world that would so effectively help one to survive even the most atrocious experience as the knowledge that there's meaning to one's life.
Yeah, having a purpose.
Right. So if we go back to my drug addiction, remember after my motorcycle accident and the physical therapy, I didn't want to be here. I resented the fact that I was allowed to survive. I was doing all these self-deprecating behaviors in a passive suicide attempt. And one day, after about 2.5 years in this addiction, I'm sitting on a park bench. It's another hot August evening, roughly 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, and the sun's just getting ready to set. It's casting this beautiful golden hue, cascading over the Rocky Mountains here in sunny Colorado where I live. And I'm sitting on this park bench having not slept in the last 2 days, and there's nobody in the park. Nobody at all. This is a place where in my deepest despair, I would go and sit and watch kids play soccer and fly kites and fish in the ponds. And there were two playgrounds and they would play tag, and you would see families out there walking the dogs. And this was where I would go to remind myself that there was still happiness, joy, and beauty in the world, even though it wasn't in my world. And I'm sitting on this bench all alone, completely ostracized. I've lost everything and everybody that I ever cared about. And I'm looking around and there's nobody there, alone and destitute, the epitome of solitude. And I start to cry. And something speaks to me in a voice that echoes through every cell of my body. Like, it wasn't audible in my tympanum, Sharon. It wasn't part of my subconscious because I was intimately familiar with the voices in my head. But this was a voice that literally echoed every cell of my being, like I'm standing 2 feet in front of the speakers at a rock concert. Like my cells are vibrating. And this voice says, if you don't stop what you're doing, we're going to take it back.
Did that shock you? How did you react?
Oh, I started to bawl. Like weep, snot bubbles, you know, the whole nine, like weeping, sobbing, crying, bubbling over. And it was in that moment, it was the very first time in my entire life that I felt like there was some reason to my existence. There was some purpose to my being here. If something or someone, and I'm not a religious person by nature, hence the reason that I probably fell into this and didn't have the saving grace that you had to counterbalance your negative beliefs. But it was the first time in my entire life, like I felt there was some reason why I was here. And if somebody or something or some council of some things made the decision not to allow me to die the day that I wrecked my motorcycle, they want me here even more than I want to be here. So there must be some reason for it.
And you know, it's interesting when I look at a name, Brian, I can tell the seven reasons the soul has chosen to come and to give reason to a person's life. And your name says that whatever you're going to do, you are going to do to the best of your ability. So the fact that you did not succeed when attempting suicide with your name, that is surprising. It means that you were not allowed to succeed.
Completely. I speak a lot for the Alliance of Suicide Prevention and an organization, nonprofit organization here in Larimer County called Imagine Zero. And they're pretty firm on not expressing the method or technique that one attempts when they're talking about their suicide story. If you're interested, I'd be more than happy to tell you the divine serendipity of that experience as well. It's crazy, but what do you think? Should I share?
I really want to know how you turn this around. So this is my goal. Okay. In today's world, there are so many people that are getting depressed, and it's so easy to get depressed because of what's going on outside of us that we feel like we have absolutely no control over what's happening in our world. Okay.
Correct.
And I think depression's easier to go in that direction when you feel that everything is out of control. Okay. And to me, fear is just a lack of information. And I think fear comes with depression. Fear is, it's not going to get any better. There's right. nothing I can do about it. And here we go. Why should I be here? Okay.
The thought that today is as good as it will ever get and today is freaking awful.
Or in the past are the best days that are ever getting, and every day is getting worse than the day before.
Right.
Exactly. I'm going in the wrong direction. So what I'm really curious about, Brian, is if somebody's depressed, if somebody's ready for suicide, I want to know what you would tell them, what you would have that person do. Now, I want to, for full disclosure here, when I became a school administrator at the central office level, I was in charge of all the counselors for the district, and I instituted a suicide prevention hotline and gave all of our counselors training in how to recognize suicide and depression, because I felt from being in the high school as an academic dean that this was a very serious problem.
It's an epidemic way beyond what we're experiencing currently with the virus. This nihilistic belief that's pervasive throughout our youth today, nihilism being the belief that nothing I do matters, nothing in the world matters, my existence doesn't matter. That thing is the one thing that causes the most consternation and pain, is that the world would be better off without us, or at best, our existence means absolutely nothing. I want to impart or inoculate the listeners with the understanding that first, there are no mistakes. If your time was up and there was nothing left that you can contribute, if you didn't have something special within you, then your time would be up. You wouldn't still be here. So don't go down the road that I went. Don't wait for a motorcycle accident and a suicide attempt and drug addiction to understand that the very fact that you woke up this morning and there's air fills your lungs, you're meant to do something important. You have a gift that's unique unto only you, that only you can deliver the world. And as long as you're here, your goal is to figure out what that is and find a way to deliver it. So that's the first understanding. The understanding that air filled your lungs, there's some purpose to your existence, not because you had a have or haven't had a conversation with God on a park bench, but the very fact that you still exist means that there's some reason why you're here.
So I look at that as, and what you can often hear me saying is that God doesn't make mistakes. And if God made you, there's a reason. You're not a mistake.
Exactly. We've all had that, oh crap moment where we are about to run a stoplight, or somebody else almost runs a stoplight, or a log falls off a truck on the highway, or we slip in the shower. We've all had these near miss situations where things could have gone the other way. When your time is up, there are no accidents. When your time is up and there's nothing you can do about it. So the very fact that we're here and we're still breathing means that there's something that you're meant to contribute, something positive that you're meant to bring to the world. So with that belief and that understanding, if you can arrive at that place, okay, maybe I don't know what that is. Maybe I don't feel like there's something that I can do. Maybe I don't even believe that there's something important that I'm supposed to bring the world, but somebody else does. The higher power, whatever you want to call it, something else believes that. So if you can ascribe or subscribe to that belief, then begin the search. Okay, what am I meant to do? What can I do? What are my gifts? Open up your mind and just begin asking yourself the question gently. If it is true that I'm meant to do something, what might that something be? If it is true that I might have something special, what might that something be? And just ask yourself the question gently, not expecting to arrive at an answer immediately, just opening up to the possibility that that might be true. Because if we try to force ourselves into that, we have cognitive dissonance, right? It's like we look in the mirror and we tell ourselves that we're attractive, and the first thought we think is, no, you're not. Or I'm lovable. No, you're not. Or I'm important. No, I'm not. So sometimes we want to avoid that cognitive dissonance and just ask in a more gentle way, okay, maybe I don't believe this, but if I did, if there was some purpose to my existence, what might that be? So start asking yourself that question. That's step two.
Okay, let me interject just for a minute.
Please.
If anybody is having a problem or trouble, or that step two just seems impossible to do, know that the first Thursday of every month on this show, that stuff is held in your name, that you can call in and simply ask, what does my name say I'm here to do? And I am happy to give you that answer, and we can just shortcut that whole process so that if you're struggling with it, you've got an answer that says that's just in 2 weeks. You can call in and we'll discuss it. Okay, keep going, Brian.
Well, Step I love three. How this tied back into what you do and the gift that you've been given and how you can use that to help the world. I love that. I kind of lost track on my third thing. So if you can ask me another couple probing questions, I'll try to arrive at that rather than sitting here in silence.
Okay, sounds good. So the two most important lessons that you have learned, if I'm hearing you correctly, is one is that everybody is important and everybody has a reason to be here. So that was your lesson, that you are important. You have a reason to be alive.
Absolutely.
And the second reason that you're saying that is that you can also assist others so that you're not alone. You have a gift to share. And in your name, Brian, it literally says you want to make the world a better place.
That's ironic because the name of my nonprofit organization is A World Empowered.
Yeah, and wouldn't that be nice if everybody was empowered? And the workshop that I was giving today, the seminar, I was talking about sovereignty, that we are sovereign beings. And as sovereign beings, you know, think of a king. A king is a sovereign being. A king is not going to tell another king what to do. And a king is not going to take orders from anybody. And we are sovereign beings. That's how we were created. And so it's very difficult at times to hold on to your being a sovereign being, and you're in a world that constantly is trying to tell you what to do.
Absolutely.
Especially now.
We also have a very disempowering habit as human beings. We want to compartmentalize and label everything. And it becomes disempowering when we try to do that to ourselves, especially to the degree that we want to define whether or not we are a good person. I'm a good person or I'm a bad person. I'm an attractive person or I'm an ugly person. When we try to label ourselves as something, we confine ourselves to a one-dimensional existence. And I think that something that could be very valuable and beneficial for our audience is the understanding. Picture a giant diamond, multifaceted. You look into this diamond and there are windows and fractals, and there are different sides and shapes to every aspect of us. And to understand that we are never one dimensional, we are never one thing, but we have the choice. If we understand that we possess the capacity to express the full range of human emotion at any given point in any given situation, but we also possess the capacity to choose which side of that diamond we want to show up and express in that given moment. We don't have to label ourselves as good or bad, as smart or stupid, as attractive or ugly. We get to choose how we show up.
Even if we feel like carbon.
Exactly.
We can still show up and look like a diamond. So
it's a very empowering place to come from, to realize that I have the choice of how I want to show up. Yes, I am capable of doing very horrible things, being very mean and ugly to people, or I can show up and be very generous, kind, and loving to people. I have the choice. I'm not one thing or the other. That's super important, super empowering, excuse me. And the other thing that I started doing is when it goes back to disarming the cognitive dissonance, you know, I've been doing different modalities of personal growth and therapy basically since my early to mid 20s, 24-ish, 24, 25 years old. EMDR, hypnotherapy, psychotherapy, talk therapy, EFT, you name it, I've done it. And I arrived at the understanding of a question that's helped me immensely. And I would encourage your audience to write this down. How would I feel and how would I respond if I did feel blank? So we have this little negative jerk on our shoulder constantly deriding us, saying derogatory things, trying to tear us down, our negative self-conscious subconscious. So whenever something comes up and we're feeling less than, or we're what's another good example? It shows up a lot in relationships when we're insecure or we're feeling jealous. And we can ask ourselves the question, how would I feel and how would I respond if I did believe I was lovable? How would I feel and how would I respond in this situation if I did believe I was attractive? How would I feel and how would I respond if I did believe that I was confident? And that gives us an opportunity. First of all, it eliminates the cognitive dissonance thing. You can't just tell yourself, I'm lovable, I'm lovable, I'm lovable. It takes a million times of doing that before it has any effect whatsoever. And it's exhausting, to be quite honest. But it gives us the opportunity to come from a place of imagination. Okay, I don't feel this way, but if I did, I would probably be more confident. I would probably show up and respond this way. I wouldn't take it personal. It just gives us an opportunity to imagine how we would feel and gives us an opportunity to disarm the negative feeling. And that's been super powerful and impactful in my life.
This reminds me of a previous guest that we had on the show that was talking about analyzing handwriting. Okay. And she has a whole way that she thinks all the letters ought to be formed that would give us that through the brain-hand connection. And one of the things she said was, literally, instead of assuming or waiting for somebody to love us, right, and assume that we're not lovable, what if you went out in the world and acted as if everybody loved you? And so if they did something that was unloving, you would respond in total surprise, like, where did that come from? I'm so lovable.
Right.
You know, and to act it. And it's interesting because at the Monroe Institute, one of the things that I heard while I was there was just fake it till you make it.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that a million times.
Right. Just pretend it's real until it is. But some of what you've been saying, Brian, I've been writing little notes on my paper. And when you said, you know, for jealousy, and I thought, you know, you split that word up. I'm so into words and spelling. It spells just lousy almost. It's you know, I mean, jealousy ends in the word lousy.
Lousy. It's an accurate representation of one of the worst feelings a person can have.
Yeah. And then other things you were saying, I thought, you know, that is really duality thinking. And supposedly we are all going toward oneness, right? And so when we think this is right or this is wrong, it is duality thinking. And if we're thinking that we're not lovable, then that means they are, but we're not. Again, that's duality thinking. And it comes down to switch duality thinking into what is being called more often than not oneness thinking, which is what's appropriate versus what's inappropriate. So if I was yelling in the football field and I'm out there playing football and I'm yelling, absolutely appropriate because that's how people can hear each other. However, if I'm yelling and I'm sitting in the library, absolutely inappropriate because that disturbs everybody's peace. So it's not our actions that are good or bad. It's the appropriateness of our action for wherever we are. Given the situation. And if we can think of appropriateness versus judgment, judgment is duality. And I believe that's why so many of the wonderful books that I've read say, thou shalt not judge. And it's because it puts us in duality instead of in oneness.
That, and we cannot judge another without simultaneously judging ourselves. It's not possible.
Yeah, it's just like when somebody points one finger at somebody else, there's four pointing back at you. Got it.
Always. And we can't look up or down at another person without putting us in the picture. So if we're judging somebody else, we're simultaneously judging ourselves. And it's at least 50-50 whether or not that judgment of ourselves is positive or negative. Usually much worse than that, much more negative than that.
I've got three questions I really want to hear your answer to.
Okay.
And the first one is, what is 20 Tuesday?
20 Tuesday is a YouTube group or community that I began in 2018, I believe. The idea is that we all gather together for 20 minutes every Tuesday to meditate to raise the vibration of the planet. So they're guided meditations with specific messages varying from eliminating fear to cleaning up the planet and the oceans, environmental things. So that is the community that we created to get together and meditate for 20 minutes every Tuesday on YouTube.
And what time is that?
Well, being on YouTube, it's at one's leisure. I should start doing them on Facebook Live activity, but they're on YouTube right now. So you can go there and listen to the recorded guided meditations whenever you want. Anytime. The idea was basically any time on Tuesday.
Okay. So the second question I want to ask you, make sure I get an answer to, is why did you write The Dream Achiever, and what would somebody gain from reading it?
Well, first of all, I'm not entirely sure that I wrote it, to be honest with you. I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning with the first half a dozen lines circling my head like a Goodyear blimp at a Super Bowl or something. And I sat up in bed and I'm like, holy crap, I got to do something with this. So I ran and put on a pair of sweats and went to the computer and typey, typey, typey for like 4.5 hours later, the whole thing was done. So I feel like I was kind of a conduit for this message.
We call it inspired.
Yeah. Well, I think that the universe gave me the message to put it into a book because it knew that I was the type of person that would deliver it to the world. And the message, the story of the story is the story. I mean, it took me 7 years to turn this book or to bring this book to reality. I hired one illustrator, paid her $1,500. 6 months later, she was gone, just ghosted, stopped returning emails, stopped returning phone calls, gone. A year and a half later, I hired another illustrator, paid $800 deposit, three illustrations in, the quality of their work just tanked. Another year and a half later, I found another illustrator, same deal, gave them a $750 deposit. Three illustrations later, their quality just tanked. So it took me 7 years to turn this book into a reality. And
how incredible you didn't give up.
I mean, at times I sort of did. I mean,
no, you took breaks. You didn't give up.
I did take breaks. I was a little bit of a tortoise and the hare analogy. I was definitely the hare. I would work really, really hard, and then I'd get depressed and have a failure, and I'd set it under the bed for a while, and then somebody else would come into my life and remind me that this was important and get me all inspired that this could be a reality, and then I'd run and run and run, and then something else would happen, and I'd set it on a shelf. And yeah, so The Dream Achiever is to remind – you know who – it's been really interesting watching the people who respond the most to this. The demographic who resonates the most are actually 50 to 65 year old females. And at the beginning, that was really interesting to me because I kind of assumed that this would be an ideal book for middle school and high school kids or college graduates to remind them that all of their dreams can come true if they just keep going, if they have the hard work and the persistence and the belief in themselves. Come to find out, the biggest audience that really resonates with this message are middle-aged women, and that's probably because they have put all of their dreams on hold for the last 40 years to raise a family and to fulfill that role. And now that the nest is empty, so to speak, they're like, they hear this story and they literally come up to me in tears saying, Brian, I had no idea how long I had put my dreams on a shelf. I had no idea how much of myself I let slip by, how many things that I wanted to do that I never set out and actually accomplished because I was doing these other things. But it's phenomenally powerful to youth as well, especially those that lack inspiration and a belief that they can do anything important in the world.
Well, and I think what's really interesting is what you said, the demographics for your book is very close to the demographics for this radio show on Who Likes to Listen. And the other thing I think that's interesting that ties in is one of the very last things that my dad said to me was that he said that he always had a hard time with me because I went out and did what I thought I ought to do, but that I was living my life for me. And that his one big regret was that he felt he lived his life for the expectations of everybody else and that he never did what he really wanted to do.
That's a powerful lesson for everybody, right?
I think so. And especially when he said, I was very close to my dad growing up, but as we got to be adults, there always seemed to be a distance there. So for him to say toward the end of his life that the distance was caused because I was living my life for me. And it reminded him every time he saw me go travel someplace to learn something from somebody, which was my big thing, that it reminded him that he wasn't living his life for him. He was living it for the expectations, to fulfill those expectations that other people had for him. Now, he was a good man. He was a physician. He was a phenomenal physician. He helped so many people. But he felt like he didn't do what he really wanted to do.
It sounds like ultimately the only reason you were a challenge to him is because you were a mirror and you shone back all the areas that he wished that he could have lived.
I don't know, or that he couldn't control me, or that neither of them could, you know. And I look at that and I think I must have been a really hard kid to rear. I mean, I always laugh about the time I used to jump the fence. I used to love to go to the library every Saturday morning and read as much as I could. And I used to jump the fence, the neighbors in the backyard, jump their fence. And then that way it was a shortcut and it would save me like 3 or 4 blocks walking to the library. And so he came to me one Saturday and he said, Sharon, the neighbors are complaining that when you're jumping the fence, you're leaving footprints on their fence and they really don't appreciate it. And the fence wasn't made for you to get on it and jump over it and whatnot. And so would you promise me that on the way to the library, when you go down there today, that you don't jump the fence? And I said, okay, Dad, I promise. And so when he came home from work that Saturday, he looked at me and he said, did you jump the fence on the way home from the library? And I said, yes, I did. And he said, I knew I said it wrong after I left the house. I made you promise not to do it on the way down there. I said nothing about the way back, and I knew you would jump that fence on the way back. And I thought, if you know that, I'm taking it literally. I'm making a literal promise. But by God, I'm going to do what I want to do when I'm not promising not to do something.
I'm going to find a loophole in your close communication.
Exactly. And I was
the same way. When I was a kid, I used to climb up the slide and down the ladder. I always did everything backwards. And the best way to get me to do something was tell me that I couldn't do it.
Well, see, and I look at that and I think, because we know as a soul that we're a sovereign being. Now, I want to look at something, the depression, from a spiritual aspect for just a minute. And that is what I noticed from being in charge of all the counselors in that job that I had when I was in central office, was that the children who became depressed, and I had really worked with them as an academic dean first and then on a bigger scale when I went to central office. But the children who became depressed, it appeared to me that they were being pushed or thought they should go in a different direction from what their soul desired. Mm-hmm. And so it occurred to me that when we're going off path for the reason that we are here, that's what causes our depression. And only by getting back on path do we cure that depression.
That resonates with me deeply. I ran a furniture company for 15 years. And about 12 years into that experience, and I was good at it. I really enjoyed making things out of my hands, Sharon, to be able to step back at the end of the day and look at what I had created. But I had a dream one night about 12 years into running my furniture company, and I was being called to account. And this council or commission or whatever asked me, if this is all that you ever do with your life, will you consider it a success or a waste? And I woke up again bawling, like sobbing. My pillow was soaked. I was just in tears. And I realized that if all I ever did was build furniture for people, no matter how gifted and talented I was at that, I wouldn't have considered my second chance well used. I would have considered my second chance, my time here on earth, wasted. So that's when I began to look for different ways to have a bigger impact on the people around me. I shut my furniture company down. I spent a year traveling around the world, living out of a backpack, living in developing countries, Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore, you name it, all over the world, in Indonesia. And everywhere that I went, I found something that I wanted to do in those communities. And that's how A World Empowered, my nonprofit, came about. And I definitely feel that I am living on purpose, that that is my soul's calling. Winston Churchill once wrote, in the middle of World War II, "I feel as though I'm walking with destiny, as if my whole life has been but a preparation for this moment in this challenge." And that's kind of how I feel every day that I wake up, that everything to this point in my life has prepared me to be doing what I'm doing. And I want to remind people, one of the greatest gifts I can offer, I think, in this time here is to let people know that tomorrow can be better than today, that whoever you think you are, you have an opportunity to influence that for the better. And you get to choose, like the diamond, how we show up and what we do with this life that we have.
I think that's wonderful. And I want to say your pitch again, just to make sure that everybody got to hear it. And your pitch that I so remember was, "I know why people struggle and why they don't achieve. I know why it's hard to rise and sometimes hard to breathe. When you feel like your life lacks meaning and there's no purpose why you're here, there's nothing in the world to care about and nothing to hold dear." And that is a beautiful way of saying, "I'm depressed. And yet there is so much beauty in the world, so many gifts in every single lifetime." It's tapping into that and literally working our way through the depression, because that is simply saying we're off path and we need to get back on. So if there's one last thing, Brian, that you would like to tell everybody, and I want to tell everybody, and I've been remiss because I've been so interested in your conversation. If you would like to get a hold of Brian, you can write him at aworldempowered@gmail.com, or you can go to the website aworldempowered.com, and you can see some of the incredible things that Brian's spending his time doing, how you can get involved if you'd like to, how you can be uplifted, and how you can come away with just, there is such a love of beauty. And I'm talking about the beauty of life and having a life and being grateful that we are still walking on the planet, that we still have an opportunity to be creative and to love and be loved. And I always think the most important person to love is yourself, because how can you truly love somebody else if you don't love you first? Because how do you know what love is if you don't love you first?
That's the only relationship in this world that really matters, actually. All other relationships spin off of that feeling, that sense.
And I don't think that's something that we're taught. I think it's something that each person has to find for themselves. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I know that's 100% true. We always try to believe that we have to love other people and take care of other people, be kind to other people. And nobody ever teaches us the importance and value of learning to appreciate and love ourselves and to take care of ourselves. And yeah, that's a big part of the problem. I agree 100%.
Well, I just want to let you know, Brian, it has been an absolute joy for you to join us tonight. I am so delighted that you took your time out, that you worked out the technical difficulties, and that you were able to spend your time with us.
Hey, it's been an interesting day, and here I am sitting in the Marriott, and hopefully the audio for the recording and the radio have been good. I've really enjoyed this, Sharon. I can't express how humbled and honored I am to have this opportunity to hopefully be an example for people. If I can come from a depressed, suicidal meth addict who wrecked a motorcycle and died to running a furniture company, writing a book, and starting a nonprofit organization. If I could do it, anybody can do it. It's not to espouse or tout my own accolades. It's just to be an example and show that what is possible for other people, and tomorrow can be better than today.
I think you're a great inspiration. Like I said, when you got up there and pitched with your poem and then told part of your story, and I know everybody had limited time when they were pitching, it's what I went, this man has learned to have a heart. I want him on. And I think we all got to feel that tonight. So I thank you.
Thank you.
So again, if you want to connect with Brian, his email is aworldempowered@gmail.com, and his website is aworldempowered.com. Next week, we have an interesting guest on, and that is Carol Matthews. And she is someone who, again, contacts people that are on the other side. And she does it totally differently than our last guest, which was Susan Rowland, and how she connects. Carol connects totally differently. She was recommended to me. We are exploring Carol's talents together. I'm not real familiar with her. She came highly recommended from a very good friend of mine that's a shaman. And so it'll be interesting to see what she does on the radio with us next week. And as always, I wish you the very best. Have a fabulous week. And I look forward to connecting with you again next week on Know the Name, Know the Answers. This is your host, Sharon Lynn Wyeth, signing off.